Richie isn't your ordinary 13-year-old boy. He's a science genius, and the whole town knows it. For his sixth grade science fair, he invented what he calls radioactive fusion atomic blaster. Well, it seemed like a good idea at the time, but now American spies and Nazis are fighting over his invention, hoping to turn it into a nuclear bomb. As far as we know, it never really happened, but it is the plot of the musical The Milford Project. And yes, it is as crazy as it sounds. Scott Ripley's a professor of dramatic art and directing at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's also a director of The Milford Project, which is performed at UNC February 23rd through the 27th, and joins me in the studio now. Welcome, Scott. Good to have you
here. Thanks. It's great to be here.
Tell us about the story.
So it's this boy. He's kind of the star of the town, and they're hoping that this year they can actually win the state science fair final. And he invents this very powerful nuclear reactor that has a plutonium core, and then he's pulled in many different directions. His father is approaching a kind of a midlife crisis, and he's dealing with his arch nemesis, who is this evil scientist from another school in the big city of Des Moines. And he's coerced by this American spy to expand his reacting chamber so that he can use it as a weapon. And then there are Nazi spies in town that are also trying to get the plans. And the whole while he's falling in love and coming of age with his lab partner, who is a young girl named Penny. And they invent something that he tries to call snur, and then she decides maybe we should call it love. And they decide that this invention could probably be a much better invention than his original thing.
And mayhem ensues.
Yes, exactly.
That's great. So this predates the Cold War and actually predates World War II, but mm-hmm. we do have Nazis, of course, at this time. So all this stuff is going on. What made you decide to direct it?
My boss, the chair of the Department of Dramatic Art, asked me last spring if I would direct a show, which is rare actually for the faculty. The faculty who are actors, you know, we have a very close association with playmakers, so we spend a lot of our time acting. So it's rare that a faculty member who's an actor in the department can actually direct a show. So I jumped at the chance because I really love directing. And my girlfriend was in the premiere production in Los Angeles in the Hollywood Fringe in the summer. And I really didn't have a project that I was very excited about. And then when I saw Milford, I thought, wow, this has got to be the thing that I do. Partly because it's a very big cast and I knew I could have a big troupe, which is what I wanted to have. But also because I'm very I'm more and more interested in a commedia dell'arte. I've spent several summers over the last couple of years in Italy studying this and training in commedia. And this piece lends itself to that style. It's really the only way I think you can do this piece. It's very farcical. It's very much it's very aware of itself. Mm. So you really need that audience. That commedia really, in its most basic form, is for and with the audience. So that with component is really important.
Tell us a little bit more about that. The fourth wall is really deliberately penetrated.
Yeah. There really is no fourth wall. I mean, right from the very, in fact, the very first moment is Richie as an old man, and he's in this building, and he realizes that there's actually some people there, and he says, "Oh, I didn't notice you there, and want to hear a story." And then he starts to tell it. So really, I'd say almost half of what happens on stage is actually directed right at the audience. So we have our first audience tonight, so we're really looking forward to that because you can't really tell how it's going to work until they're there.
How is that useful, or what's the value? You know, so often directors spend a lot of time and want that fourth wall there. They want the audience engaged in what's happening, and they want the actors to be thoroughly engaged in the fiction that they're creating.
Yeah, well, for me, the reason why I've been in theater for many years, and I've tried to get out. But it just keeps pulling me back in. And the reason why I can't leave the theater ever, I think, in my life is because it's a community. And that's something that I see in our culture becoming a more and more critical aspect of our culture. And, you know, nowadays audiences will sometimes come into a theater and they treat that experience as if it's a film. And the truth is that night to night, every audience has a collective personality, which means the show is different every night. I mean, if you see a show on Thursday night and then you go back and see it on Friday night, it will be a different experience. And really, that key component is the audience. So for me, it's really important that the audience comes and they realize I'm a part of this happening.
And as you said, the play itself is very self-aware. Give us some examples of how the play knows that there's people watching.
Oh, yeah. Well, we so there's this moment where they're in this meadow, and I was talking with my great scenic designer, Jauncey, and I said, you know, I really want a bird to fly in here. And of course, most people, especially people, you know, I'm collaborating with people that are between the ages of 18 and 23. And most of them have spent their entire lives being brought up on realism. So immediately they go to a realistic place and they start thinking about, okay, how do I? And, you know, I said to her, you know, I want it on a black string. I want it to not, it should look terrible. I mean, the audience should never for a moment be able to suspend their disbelief because this bird just comes thudding down onto the stage and then flies back out, you know? So none of the props are realistic. The set starts, looks realistic when you first walk in, which is also by design because I want to break out of that. So I want the audience to feel comfortable, you know, here we're in this realistic set. And then, you know, immediately they're aware of the fact, oh, this is just a cartoon, essentially.
Another element in Commedia dell'arte, of course, is the idea of archetypes, using masks as types when the characters are created. I mean, did you use that? Is that part of the production? And is it inherent in the play?
Oh, definitely. All of the characters really are archetypal. And I'm glad you brought that up. That's an essential part of actually getting into this world. And it's a part that, again, some of these actors had a hard time getting into. I mean, it took a week or two for some of them to get into to be as big as a cartoon needs to be. As an archetype needs to be. So yeah, I guess it was maybe around the end of the first week of rehearsal, I brought in some leather masks that I have that I like to play with, and we just played with them. You know, I did just a quick workshop, and it was amazing to watch how these actors found their big self through that device.
We'll talk about the value of the big self as our conversation about the Milford Project continues with Scott Ripley, a professor of dramatic art and directing at UNC Chapel Hill. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking today about the Milford Project, a play at UNC directed by Scott Ripley, my guest in the studio. And before the break, you were talking about discovering, for the actors, their big selves using masks and archetypes. What's the value of that? Why do that?
Well, first of all, it's essential for this, for the aesthetic of this production. You know, I kept telling them, you are not a human being, you're a cartoon. And so it has to, you know, cartoon characters are, like you said, archetypal characters are huge. They're so big because they're illustrating their archetypalness, if you will.
Yeah.
So it really helped them get into the world. It was very important for them to be to have a playful approach to the work, because a lot of our rehearsal was improvisation. Even some of the things that you'll see at the actual performance are improvised. There are a lot of things. There's an element of Commedia dell'arte called Lazzi, which is a comic bit, and the basis of Lazzi is that it doesn't further the plot in any way, and it can be 2 seconds long, and it can be, we have one that's probably 2.5 minutes long, this comic Lazzi, and it was really important to me that they felt free and inventive so that they could find those things in the script, because of course they're not scripted.
It's one of the, and do they stay in, or is there sort of an improvisational component every night? Can things change every night?
Yes, the show will definitely be different. Yeah. Some of it is set-ish, of course, but we were at a faculty meeting on Monday, and one of my colleagues asked me the running time, And I said, well, it's give or take 10 minutes because really it's up to the performers when they're in the middle of this comic Lhotse. Is it playing? If it plays, play it as long as it does. And then, you know, if you kind of have to feel, okay, this it's time to now come out of the Lhotse and then just to start telling the story.
It's interesting that you would reprise, in a sense, this cartoonish quality. It goes back a long ways, Commedia dell'arte. And yet, if you think about the struggle of sort of in postmodern art and in a lot of theater, the idea that we're trying to examine consciousness, which we don't quite think is as linear as we used to think you know, back in the good old 19th century. How do you do that? And one way is to sort of just break things up and leave it to the audience to either put them together or understand I'm talking about the brokenness. The other way is to play with my imagination the way you do in these with these effects, to have this kind of cartoon bubble stretch itself out, watch what happens to my mind, and then go back to a narrative that I could follow. It seems to me a much more productive way to examine these very interesting questions about how we truly perceive.
Yeah, well, I love that you say that you put it that way because the thing that I love about the theater is what makes it unique, and that is obviously theatricality. Requires the audience to participate because it requires the audience's imagination, which is why I'm less and less interested in anything realistic on stage. Because I mean, why would I go to New York to watch this sort of Titanic ship sort of sink when I can pay $10 and see the real thing on the screen, right? Mm-hmm. But you can stage that moment in such a way that the audience sees it in their head. And that, to me, first of all, is it makes the audience an active participant. But also, you know, I remember the first time I saw the first Harry Potter movie, and I saw the CGI Dobby, and I thought, okay, I mean, that's great, but it's not Dobby. I've got Dobby in my head. Right. That's a way better Dobby, you know. So requiring the audience to use their imagination is a key part of theatricality, and that's really why I'm interested in this kind of work.
And going back to the plot of this particular play, we've got a 13-year-old boy in 1937 with a science project, and so you did some field trips, didn't you, around the town?
We did, yeah. One of the things that I wanted to do with, you know, we have an incredible facility at UNC, the best I've seen any place that I've taught. We have this amazing association with Playmakers Rep, a regional theater, Lord Theater, Resident Theater, which is such a, if I were studying acting, there's no place I would go other than where I am right now as a professor. And because we have such a great facility, it's really easy to never leave the building. Office is a 30-second walk from the rehearsal room, and it's all in the shops. We build everything in the building. Yeah. So it can be it can become kind of insulated, which, of course, is contrary to that idea of community in some ways. So I really wanted to reach across campus. Our first meeting for this project was actually at the Student Center because I was trying to recruit students from other parts of the campus, from other departments. And the other thing is I wanted to reach out into the community. And I'm really interested in when does, if you go to see a play, when does that experience start? Does it start when you walk into the lobby? Does it start when you walk into the theater, when the lights go down? And when does it end? So I had this idea of actually having a science fair in the lobby that was actually constructed by students of this age so that the audience subconsciously has entered the world of the play before they've even walked into the theater. So I found this amazing science teacher at Woods Charter School, Kevin Pease, and he's just wonderful. And he took this ball and ran with it. And I gave him the script, and I asked him, if we could have a Hawaiian punch tornado and a couple of other things that are actually mentioned in one of the songs. And his kids, 40 of them, they made these science fair projects. And we actually had a science fair in the theater at UNC yesterday. They took a field trip from Woods Charter School. And one of the guys in this cast, actually, who plays Richie, the scientist, posted on his Facebook wall yesterday. He's a senior. The best day of college ever, and it was his experience with these sixth graders.
Bringing them in,
school. Yeah. So, that's the kind of experience to me that kind of transcends the theatrical experience.
Scott, thanks so much. for being on the program.
Yeah, great to be here.
Scott Ripley, a professor of dramatic art and directing at UNC Chapel Hill. He is directing The Milford Project. It's going to be performed at UNC from February 23rd through the 27th at the Keenan Theater. And you can find more information about the production at unc milford project.wordpress.com.